So our next speaker is Dr. Steven Vedel. He is the Dissemination Activities Director of the Genetics Policy in the Department of Health Management and Policy at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. He is the Chief Evaluation Specialist for the NIH-funded Midwest Community Genetics Forums and recent Genome Community Think Tank. He also co-teaches the Issues in Public Health Genetics course at the University of Michigan, and he is going to talk to us about racial and ethnic identity inclusion in genetics education. So.
Well, thanks everybody for making it out on this frosty morning in Denver. We're the high energy bunch. The title of my talk is Racial Ethnic Identity, the Missing Piece in School-Based Genetics Education. I'd like to recognize my colleagues, Toby Citrin and Sharon Cardia. I have no conflicts of interest to declare. Between January 2006 and April 2007, the National Science Foundation funded research community on genetics and racial ethnic identity at the University of Michigan brought together 9 speakers and 36 academic participants from the genetics field, from public health, and the social sciences. Over 6 seminars, several of them having multiple talks. The main goal was to bring together these scholars to further transdisciplinary research and teaching on the impact of genomics on our perceptions of racial and ethnic identity. We also had several educational goals to develop new models and graphical representations to clearly explain how genes act in concert with environmental and historical and time-related factors, and to discern what types of educational policies might be implemented in the schools and with the media to reduce genetic essentialist beliefs about human difference. Now, I'd like to move immediately into several examples to concretize this. The first one being from Celeste Condit, who's a professor in communications at University of Georgia and one of our investigators in this project. She's written extensively on the impact of news stories on people's beliefs in genetic determinism and popular concepts of race. In her study on the impact of multiple genetic messages on racist attitudes in young adults, Dr. Condit exposed the young participants to the headlines of several relevant genetics-related articles found on LexisNexis, to news lead paragraphs, 2 genetics commercials, and a Channel 22 news segment. She found no increase on the genetic determinism and genetic discrimination scales, but did observe increases in the genetically based racism measure that she was using. This scale measures the belief that races are genetically distinct and the differences between races are genetic. She concluded that what was observed was a shift in belief from the social structures as determinants of behavior to genes as determinants. Now, the worrisome aspect of this is that Edmund and Rojecki argue that the images of African American people get coded onto crime scenes on TV. And you yourself can think of examples. For example, the Tom Hanks movie, The Green Mile, or the O.J. Simpson case. Increasingly, medical and crime dramas depict the use of genetics to solve medical and crime mysteries, so that genetic testing can come to be viewed as an instrument for identifying people of a particular racial ethnic background. This is my second example, even though it says example 1, but I made the change in my notes, so I performed an epigenetic modification. This is from Rebecca Bigler, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Texas, Austin, and who is also a part of our project. She is especially well known for her experiments in simulating segregation through the wearing of different shirt colors in students or placing them in different locations within the classroom. Now, prior to the Obama campaign, she invited classrooms to look at posters and encyclopedias and answer several questions related to who can and should be president. The responses, by and large, were that both African American and white people should be president. But more than 80% of the students also said that only white persons are president. Now, of course, this clearly contradicts the current reality, but you've got to remember when she was asking these questions. And it just goes to show that timing is everything, with one exception, and that's real estate, where location is everything. Okay, so not everybody has been shopping for a home recently. Now, she asked, in response to their response, how do you know? One of the students said, have you seen the money? All the faces on the money are white. The next question was, why do you think there hasn't been a black president of the United States? And an 11-year-old said, sadly, a black president is not good enough to be, a black individual is not good enough to be president. The next question was, why do you think no black president is true today? And you've got to remember the circumstances when this took place. Several of the K through 6th African American children answered, it's against the law for an African American to be president. Now, the students are clearly not being taught this. They're making a logical leap based on what they've been exposed to. I wanted to show you next some examples from young people's magazines, two of them from National Geographic for youngsters and one from Time for Youngsters. This is Binding Over Cookies, and the person in the middle who's doing very well at the cooking has Down syndrome. This is fitted with high-tech legs, and it looks like there's some fast running going on here. And the third one, this is Marianne Jones, who got an Olympic medal for running, but really this is her in the calm before the storm, because later she admitted to taking synthetic steroids. Now, can anybody guess what the common link between these three slides is? Well, the link is that the focus in these slides is on racial ethnic minority individuals. It's a little bit different than questions about the presidency, but there's just a little iota of labeling. Some of it, for better, we see athletes performing in these slides. Now, there's also a flip side to racial ethnic identity, and this is my third example, which I've also called one. So this is a triple repeat situation. And the professor here is Jackie Eccles, who is a professor of psychology at University of Michigan. She looked at more than 600 Prince George County, Maryland junior high and high school students. Now, for African-American females, she found that 8th grade achievement has a direct positive effect on 11th grade self-esteem. But for white females, valuing academic achievement in the 8th grade tends to undermine self-esteem by the 11th grade. And of course, this is averages, not specific individuals. And 8th graders, those who are culturally embedded and tending to de-emphasize the existence of future discrimination, or fully embedded, believing discrimination might affect their future, but having greater than average sense of racial ethnic pride, actually had the highest academic achievement. So that's the flip side of the coin. But our main concern is in genetic essentialism. That is, the prospect of categorizing people and thus groups under the assumption that they share certain essential or innate traits. And there are certain hypotheses behind this concept. Hirschfeld holds that there are mental modules which are evolutionary hardwired to allow discrimination of humankind as early as 6 years of age. Bigler and Leiben, on the other hand, have published several articles arguing that the salience of human features is not something that's evolutionarily hardwired, but it's inferred by children from their environment. And a look at multiple pieces of literature suggests that a multi-step process is going on, witnessing a certain situation which has certain social connotations, solidifying impressions, and receiving priming experiences on the impressions developed. Now, the question that we ask is education a solution to essentialist beliefs? Now, K through 12 science class standards have been enlarging themselves in the last couple of years, so you find topics like biodiversity and ecosystems and adaptation being talked about. However, These ideas tend to remain in the classroom in the biologic domain and isolated from students' personal and group interactive experiences, and also largely ignoring public health messages of genes operating in concert with the physical and social environments. Now, there is a consequence or price tag to this. I'd like to show you a quotation from a 44-year-old white male with a BA degree involved in biology research. This is courtesy of Toby J. Rodney, who is another investigator with our project. He admits, "I used to be a biology student. Black people moved out of Africa in the heat, and due to genetics, they turned white." Now, about the various studies that we discussed and the research methods used, these are rather long slides, but just to summarize, some of the things we touched on and the studies touched on: cultural identity and scholastic success, which we've already discussed, views of individual and group differences in traits such as athleticism and math ability, global populations, actual genetic testing of 60 different sites by Jeff Long, who's with us, and assessment of gene identity and genetic distance, the effect of cultural leverage or power relationships on physiologic status and health, stereotyping behavior in young students, and race coding in news articles and audiovisual media. I'd like to make a methodologic distinction about the project and to say that this was not design of a curriculum. Rather, it was coming together of a research community on common themes. So we had a set of three investigators, PIs. Two of them were public health. One of them was from psychology. Accreted around them were a group of core participants. And then we had, aside from the main sessions, a number of brainstorming retreats with some discussion of what final outcomes should be. Aside from the 100-plus page proceedings that we put together, another outcome was the development of proposal having curricular units that might counter genetic essentialism through education on the mutual role of genes in the social and physical environments. Another note is that this was not a phase one or a phase two project. This was a think tank percolating ideas type of a project. We did not use a community advisory board. But on the other hand, we did have three key individuals from the University of Michigan Office of Academic Multicultural Initiatives and a very important faculty member from the School of Nursing who deals heavily with Latino populations, who are part of our discussions as well as the administration of the project. Now, these various discussions evince certain common themes. One of these, of course, was genetic identity, and this notion is something that can vary depending upon which researcher you're talking about, all the way from allelic similarity to the social salience of various inherited characteristics. But all these definitions have a personal and group significance. We thoroughly discussed genetic essentialism and its implications, genetic variation, gene-environment interaction, the importance of multi-level views of factors, and the dynamic historical context, the fact that genes are malleable over historic periods of time, that people have moved around in the past, and that where they moved to, the environment has changed. Now, when we think of genetic identity, oftentimes it's a rather physically based concept. On the other hand, when we think of racial ethnic identity, it's something that has a social connotation. But one set of investigators with us, Serge Madhir and Charmaine Royal, both of whom were at Howard University at the time, described a linking concept which is biosocial identity. Now, this connotes group membership and feelings about membership forming around perceived, such as social, and biologically organized characteristics. It links the two ideas, genetic identity and racial ethnic identity. We had specific lessons that developed out of our various discussions. Some of these you place more in the genetics camp, one of them being that genetics can certainly redefine the way that students see themselves, both in terms of the way their body works. And so we showed them some of the mechanics of how genetic instructions translate into proteins that all individuals, regardless of race, ethnicity, have, and thus helping them to get below skin deep in their feeling of connection with others. A second point that discussions with students can center on within group differences and between group similarities. And the examples we used here were lactose intolerance and sickle cell anemia. Thirdly, the public misunderstanding of the way genes interact with the environment is shared by grade school students and can result in a belief that some groups essentially have more athletic or mathematical ability than others. And that genetics should be used in the schools as a way of bolstering sense of racial ethnic identity, not attempting to prove greater distance between people, as in the book you might remember, The Bell Curve. Then we had some lessons that were more environmentally oriented. One being that students need to be shown that the supposed superiority of one group over another, or the existence of health disparities, often boils down to a difference in circumstances. Food availability, differences in smoking prevalence, neighborhood environmental exposures. And these are points that can simply be inserted into a typical health education course. And we emphasize that historical examples are of great importance. We use the African diaspora and Hurricane Katrina in warning of the historic possibility of abuse of news stories and information, but also in mentioning the healing potential of examples, for example, revealing lost ancestry. There are certain more didactic technique-related lessons, one of these being that visual representations are very important. You know, I'll show you a couple of circle diagrams that we discussed. This one is from Sharon Cardia, and it's the classic biopsychosocial hierarchy, but formulated within a circle. And Sharon also likes to have arrows, so that not only do genes influence phenotype, which influences our relation with the world, but also community and what happens in the environment. She likes to talk about addicts that are with intoxicants affect the way that our genes operate. Here's a second very fascinating example. This is from the population geneticist, Jeffrey Long. On the left, you see what amounts to an essentialist concept, that we have three different racial ethnic groups and that their genetic variation is relatively independent of each other. In the middle, you have maybe a classic population geneticist concept where there's clearly a region of shared genetic diversity and variation. And on the right, basically, you have the truth that Europeans have a certain amount of genetic variation that Asians do. And in point of fact, their genetic variation is a subset of the variation that exists within Africa, our common ancestral home. If young people and adults could appreciate this model on the right, it would certainly very much change their conception of human similarity and difference. One other point I would make is that media examples used in the classroom are also very important and should teach kids to get beyond the headlines that they read about, which rarely tell the full story, that article explanations need to seek the right vocabulary and metaphors to show how a given societal condition came about, and that students need to be challenged to critically examine the media to which they are exposed. We had some general lessons that an integrative, multidisciplinary approach is needed, that public health itself can be expressed both in the content of what's discussed in the classroom, but also in terms of the outcomes that young people experience in their lives, that chronic conditions, and these have been written about in an educational sense by Michael Doherty of ASHG, are different from complex traits, and the two should be handled differently in the classroom. That in terms of the complexity of the model, keep it simple for young people, that there's a need to start young because group stereotypes can begin early, and when possible, engage parents, community members, and yes, even public health people. And I hate to say it, but oftentimes it's the young public health people who go and represent the profession in the classroom. It should be older public health people as well. Limitations. Admittedly, we did not utilize a community advisory board, but we might have benefited from this kind of input. There were a limited number of sessions, so we couldn't hit all the topics we would have preferred. For example, political beliefs and views on race, ethnicity. And there are also time issues because, of course, the academic year is very heavy and dense at certain points, and it's harder to pull out people at those times of year. Thank you. Yeah, part of the two think tank retreats we had was to think about future ideas, projects. And you had some fascinating ideas, some of them dealing with what people read in terms of news articles. Should we try to alter the wording and see what the effect of that is? That's one of several ideas. Then we had people from the sciences camp bridging their way, wanting to include more of racial, ethnic, and sociologic considerations in what they do. Jackie Eccles, who has this longitudinal study in Maryland, wanted to include stress factors in her study and maybe measure cortisol. These were several possibilities, but we have entered a grant proposal that it's educational, and what we're suggesting is the creation of educational inserts that can go beyond not just teaching genetics in the middle and high school classrooms, but also including this interface between race, ethnicity, and genetics, things that young people could really relate to. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're waiting to find out how that fares.
Well, hopefully it'll go well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.